Hello, and welcome to the Story Partners podcast. We are your hosts, Walt and Annie Maness. We're so glad you're here.
We're a team of storytellers who seek to tell stories that point people to Jesus.
Tim Brown is a retired fighter pilot that has lived a lot of life. He and his wife, Susie, are in our church community here in Austin. We found out about his story over lunch at their house one day.
For the first part of his life, Tim had a very specific view on what it was to be a man. In his 60s, God started to unravel these ideas and unlock something in him that was deeply buried. This episode is called Below the Surface.
My perception I had as a young boy, one, looking at my dad, but looking at the people I looked up to, like John Wayne, guys like that, professional, athletes, my football coach, who was very instrumental in my life, was a big hero sports guy, was that men were strong. You deal with things yourself. You don't ask for help. You obviously don't cry. You don't share your feelings. You don't even show feelings. My name is Tim Brown. I was raised in a very moral, ethical environment. So I would say, in generally, I was a good kid in other people's minds. My dad was a pastor. Everybody knew, including mom, just do what dad said. It wasn't harsh or anything, but he was definitely the authority figure. And his ways and what he thought, that's what we were going to do. I didn't see any what I would now call intimacy between my mom and dad. They were married for decades and loved each other. I'm sure you just didn't see it. They were just together. He was there at dinner. He was usually gone after dinner, but he was there at dinner. We were all together. Wasn't a very personal conversation, but it was there. I would say as a young kid, I was happy and I felt pretty secure, and I wouldn't use the word loved, but emotionally it was a very distant environment, actually. There was no personal communication. I love you, how you doing, what are you thinking? So as I said, emotionally we're just very disconnected. My dad raised me the way he was raised. And I know his dad, and you talk about being distant. He was also a minister. I mean, you're talking about people living in the 1800s and then going into the Great Depression and dealing with emotions and feelings. They didn't have time for that. My dad worked for 10 cents a quart of strawberries, just to get by as a teenager. The respect I had for my dad, and the way people respected him, he's very well-spoken and mature, honorable man. But part of that teaching inadvertently was keep your feelings to yourself. We don't put our emotions on the table. In fact, we don't talk about them. So I grew up thinking that emotions and showing emotions were a sign of weakness as a man. And I figured out in my own way of thinking, if men, women, I expected it, I guess, eventually, but men, if they were emotional or showed their emotion or cried or anything, they were weak. And so I did the best I could not to show weakness. The way I was looking for, I think, personal value besides sports was girls. And when I was in the seventh grade, I had a girlfriend, and it turns out I'd call her girlfriend, some girl. She was real streetwise. She was abusive. She liked pushing me around. I was trained to be a nice guy and polite, but she liked pushing me around and embarrassing me in front of her friends. And that went on for probably a month or something. One day we were playing cards, and she came up behind me. I was sitting down, bit me in the ear real hard, just one of her little show off things do for whatever reason. And unlike me, I stood sort of half up and smacked her right in the face, almost full force with a backhand. But I just unloaded. It had been built up for a while. I don't know where it came from, because I wasn't a violent guy. I never got in fights at school, and I got along with everybody. It just came up. The bottom line on that, fortunately, I didn't hurt her too bad. But I walked out of that apartment that night and I said, I'm never going to put my heart on the table again. I don't know where those words came from. I just knew that from the pain and being emotionally immature, not knowing how to, never should have been dating, never should date that. You know, I had no idea. But so I made what I would say I now know is a vow. And so I locked up. I just buried those emotions under a rock. And I just didn't face them, didn't deal with them. They'd show up a little bit, but I had them, you know, totally buried. I was real successful in school. I didn't have any trouble getting dates. I was real good at sports. So I got a lot of personal attention from other sources. I think my insecurities and loneliness and literally helpless feelings that I had frequently were camouflaged by the way my life was going. I believed in God. I knew about Jesus. I knew about heaven. I knew about the expectations. I didn't know anything about personal sin, accountability, knew nothing. And looking back about having a personal relationship with God. So I would say I was a believer in that sense, and my friends might have said, you know, I was a Christian guy, but I was far from a deep relationship with God. There was a guy who lived down the street, a friend of my dad's, and he was an Air Force pilot. And so when I found that out, I went down and started talking to him. He said, Tim, if you want to be an Air Force pilot, here's what you need to do. You need to go to the Air Force Academy. I said, great, I'll do that. What's that? He said, well, it's a new school. It's not built yet. They're building it out in Colorado Springs. But if you go to that school, if you graduate, you're going to be an Air Force pilot because that's what they do. You go 4-year education, you go to pilot training. I said, great, I'll do that. I went there and things went fine. I did well militarily. I did well in sports and did well academically. I didn't give a hoot, but should have. And did okay with the girls again. But time I was about a sophomore, those feelings of insecurity that I had, you just can't deny those. And I was among a bunch of guys. They were all high school heroes. They were all better than me. They were all. And those thoughts that I had about the insecurities when I wasn't getting all the applause and the crowd cheers and whatever, that stuff just didn't work anymore because the reality of how I really felt about myself was coming to bear on me, and it was very difficult. I was losing confidence significantly. And it must have been pretty apparent. I got into alcohol by the time I quit playing football, sophomore year, junior year of college. And what I found about alcohol was I could go to parties, and as long as I drank enough, I could be John Wayne. I could be whoever, and I was tough, and I was macho, and I was cool. I was dating a girl my senior year from the University of Colorado, and I remember one time, we were listening to Simon Garfunkel. He had a song called I'm a Rock. And at the end of that song, you know, this girl looked me right in the face and she said, that's your song. I don't know if you know that song, but the chorus is, I am a rock, I'm an island, because a rock feels no pain and an island never cries. And that's what she said to me right then. And I thought, I flexed my muscles and I thought, yeah, that's me. I'm tough. I'm strong. I didn't realize that she had insight what God was telling me. I had made myself a rock and an island because I refused to look at pain or suffering, and I certainly didn't cry or show any kind of weakness. So the alcohol was a way for me to act like in other people's minds, to get my nerve up, to try and be somebody that I was not.
Did you know that along with this podcast, Story Partners make short documentary films? We do. Come check us out on YouTube and subscribe to our channel to see the latest films as they release.
I graduated in 66. The Vietnam War was really cranking up in the mid-60s. We had been involved for 3 or 4 years as a U.S. The air war was definitely picking up. So you didn't have to hardly volunteer to go to war because everybody was going. The draft was red hot, and so a lot of people were going, even though it was very unpopular. But I was a volunteer from the get-go. I wanted to go to pilot training, which I did. I wanted to go to fighters, which I did. And I was a volunteer on my resume from the get-go. Then I wanted to go to the war. I wasn't an American hero or anything. I wanted to fly fighters. And we're making the best aircraft in the world, like typically, and so that's what I wanted to fly. There was a thrill about it. I loved it, just going out on the flight line and smelling jet fuel and hear the engines crank up and watch guys take off. It's just real exciting to me. Our squadron that I went to Vietnam with was the first squadron to get the latest model of the F-4. It's called the F-4E. And it was a noticeable step up from the earlier. I had an internal gun, had a radar system far superior, and had bigger, more powerful engines. So we were the first F-4E squadron in the Air Force. So to us, we were the best. In fact, our call sign in that squadron was the world's finest. And we didn't mind saying, taxi for the world's finest, for the world's finest for land, stuff like that. Vanity was a huge issue for me. So anytime you showed up someplace in a flight jacket or told somebody, you know, you're a fighter pilot, they thought you were King Kong. You'd go to a pilot training base, for example, and the guys were flying T-37s and T-38s, subsonic trainers, but you were a fighter pilot. You are already more superior to them in your thinking. My whole flying career, I got ahead of other my peers because I was the first one to the flight desk. I'll fly that mission, I'll fly. I wanted to be in the thick of it. The more dangerous missions that came up, you know, when they were known dangers, it was not uncommon that I was happy to be selected or a volunteer to go there. I was respected because I flew those missions. I was chosen for those missions. When I left the Vietnam War, I had more combat missions in the F-4E than any pilot in the Air Force. During that time, drinking was real heavy. I look back now, the fact that I even survived the war the way first of all, they're shooting at you. The second of all, you're going into it drunk half the time. There was no accountability. We drank well into the night. They didn't have breathalyzers back then, but if they had given them, we never would have passed the guys I was flying with. Everybody showed up at the bar. We're all heroes. We're all bragging. We almost got killed, and I can't wait till tomorrow. Then we go home, and we're scared to death in our bunks, and it was terrified, not of dying, but being a POW. People got killed around me. We lost people. I didn't cry. In fact, I kept all those feelings to myself. You didn't want somebody going to combat with you that was crying. You'd call them a crybaby or something like that. It was weakness. When I left Vietnam, it was my first year of marriage. We were separated. I was in the war, but we went to Germany from there. And booze is real easy to come by over there and real cheap. And so the combat lifestyle went on. My drinking and carousing, you know, went on. And we'd go out, blow stuff up, and shot up, go to the bar, do it again. Go to Europe, driving cars in the fog 100 miles an hour, racing each other. During that period, you know, we had our first child. Susie was pregnant with our second one, the one we eventually lost. And right near the end of that assignment was a 4-year tour. I was still partying real heavy. Susie was pregnant, in fact, 9 months pregnant with the second daughter. And she was my designated driver. So she went to parties and she got me home without me killing us, you know, driving. And so, this party near the end of that tour, she didn't want to go. She's 9 months pregnant. She didn't want to go to a party and stay out all night. And so on the way home that night, in the middle of the night, I wrecked the car. And I was drunk, as typical. And I blamed her for it. I blamed her. I said, you know, if you'd have been there doing what you're supposed to do, that wouldn't have happened. And she looked me right in the face and said, you know, I don't think I love you anymore. That was a shot across the bow. to me morally, even though I was immoral, living horribly, that was unacceptable. That really woke me up. How could you even have a thought like that? Even though looking back, I'm surprised she lasted that long. I didn't get the personal nature of God, but I did get the instructions, the value of the Word of God, right living, etc. I just totally disregarded, and somehow God kept his hand on me and spared my life, and I just lived in violation of that. I was not there for my wife. I was not there for those two little girls. I should have been home from work. I shouldn't have volunteered for that trip. I should have been over at school. I should have been putting the kids to bed. And it became more and more clear. So the primary conviction was, interestingly enough, my failure to my family. That started a process, that conviction, and it became more clear. About a year after she made that statement, maybe less, I was drinking with a buddy of mine, and his tactical call sign of all things was Evil. And I was talking to Evil, it was early in the evening, so we weren't too drunk yet. And I remember saying, Evil, I don't think I'm going to keep living like this. I'm not sure where that came from. My squadron was involved in this big drinking contest coming up with Marine Corps Yuma. And I was, you know, my squadron commander, he looked to me to be one of the tough guys. So we're going to have this big Air Force Marine hoo-ha, see who the real macho men are over the 4th of July weekend. And he was an Annapolis graduate, so he already hated the Marines. So it was more important to him than the rest of us. But anyway, that weekend, I decided I just didn't want to go do that. I think it's the grace of God, actually. And this friend of mine, another one of my good drinking buddies, had gotten saved, as it turned out, a couple months before. And he invited me to go to church on Sunday night that weekend. I never went to church on Sunday night. That's what the youth group did. But anyway, I decided to go. And it was a good message, a real godly place. People obviously had been praying for us. Looking back, they knew our names. But I went home that night, and I didn't say anything to Susie. And I just, before I got in bed, I just told the Lord, I'm really tired of fighting against you. I just want to go your way. I didn't have Bible verses. I didn't have, you know, lightning bolts and parting of the Red Sea. I just was really tired because I knew the truth well enough that I was resisting, you know, God, and I didn't know that much about it. I just knew I was not where I wanted to be, and I was very unhappy, very insecure. Didn't look like it on the outside. The career was fine, the flying was fine, but I was very insecure. I felt helpless, valueless, no purpose in life, and here was my precious wife, faithful she could be, and two little girls, and I was just essentially abandoning them.
Do you have a great story? We're always looking for compelling stories of how God has changed people's lives. If you have a story like this, or if you know of one, let us know. The best way is to reach out by submitting a story on our website at storypartners.org.
I told the Lord I wanted to go his way, and I went to bed. I woke up the next morning, getting ready to go to work Monday morning, and I just flip open the Bible. Not a good way to study the Bible, but it opens to Ecclesiastes 9:7. I'm just looking right at this verse. And it says, now go thy way and drink your wine and eat your bread, for thy works are now acceptable unto me. And in that moment, I felt almost like a physical force of a weight on my shoulders, like if you ever did squats, like with 1,000 pounds. I felt that weight lifted off of my back. I know he was saying, I heard your confession. I accept. That's why I said you are now acceptable in my sight. Your sins are forgiven. It was in a very visible, physical reality that happened. The test to hold me accountable happened right away, because I got on my motorcycle to go to work. As I'm driving out to the base, I realize I'm going to have to face this squadron commander. And I had abandoned ship on this big drinking who, he was a nasty guy. And I knew he was going to rip my face off. And I didn't know what to say. So I cowered in back in my office in the squadron. And when he came in, you know he's there because they call the building to attention. Squadron commander's here. He didn't get halfway down the hallway before he yelled my name. God was giving me a chance. Are you going to stand up or aren't you? You've denied me all these years. I was 31 years old at that point. Been married 7 years, had two little girls. And he said, are you going to stand up now? And so he gave me that chance. Brown, I can still hear it coming down the hall. Brown yells my name. And he takes me into his office there, and he just rips my face off. Where were you? We got humiliated, you wussy, what? And I felt like I was a cadet back at the academy. He was just chewing me out like an upperclassman. Veins standing out, he was furious. He stopped after what I thought was about an hour and a half, it was probably a minute, catch his breath because he was furious. And I didn't have any Bible verses or anything, quote, but that same thing I had said to evil came right up out of my heart. Sir, I don't think I'm going to live like that anymore. And he looked at me real hard and deep, and like trying to figure out what? You got to have a better excuse than this. But I think he saw there was a sincerity there. It's all I had. I'd gone to war with half those guys. We were drinking together, all that. We babysat for each other. We were all friends. Now, all of a sudden, I'm claiming Jesus Christ as my Lord. And I was immediately excommunicated, never invited to a party again, except official parties. Everybody made fun, you know, make sure you got brown in your flight because God will part the weather for you and all this. The angels protect him, stuff like that. So it gave me a chance to stand, you know, and have a testimony there. I appreciate that significantly. I did not have any appreciation for the personal nature of love. You can say love to me, it was a generic term. You're a good guy, you've tried to care for people. There was not a personal involvement indicated to me, which I would call intimacy. So as I got to know God, I had the exact same thought about him. The main issue became that his nature is very personal, way more personal than a human being I ever knew. God was moving in my life and calling me to himself. It definitely was a process, but part of it came real fast. I somehow knew right away we need to be in a Bible study. I've never been in one except Sunday school, but we need to be in a Bible study. The authority of the Word of God became very quickly important to me. I became a teacher. Actually, I got railroaded in, like a lot of stuff in my life. This guy that was discipling, he got fired by the church because he was proclaiming the gospel clearly and truth, and they only were interested in the social gospel. So he got fired. So he put my name in the hat to be the new adult class teacher. I hadn't been a believer 6 months. But I was in this life group, and he saw that I had a heart for the Word, even though I didn't know anything. So he announces to me that starting the new semester, I'm the adult teacher in this church. I was petrified. I had diarrhea. I'm throwing up. And I asked Susie about it. She laughs about it. But I didn't have anything except the Word of God. And I opened the Bible, and I had notes of the Word, and I almost just read them the Word. And this church was so starving, they just sucked it up. These people, the class was packed. All the adults, they were hungry for the Word. And I've been teaching the Bible ever since. That life group became critical. It actually became our church. That was a Thursday night group. We worshiped together, we evangelized together, we studied together. And so being a part of a Christian community like that, a small fellowship, became very important. My ability to be intimately be involved with my little girls or even my wife or God did not happen until later on. The Lord continued to be faithful as he is, raising up one of his kids. we took these two girls into our lives. They're abused. They're really hard place, teenagers. And they were hyper affectionate. I mean, I was everything. Dad, grandpa, best friend. And they hugged on me. And even though they were 14, 15 years old, they treated me like a dad, like, and showed me affection and value that I just did not hadn't experienced. That just blew that rock that I mentioned, that just those emotions that I had buried, it exploded them because they were ridiculously affectionate. I mean, they weren't just wanting to hold hands, they wanted to be held like little girls. Hold my hand, I love you, be with me, what are you doing, what do you think? And it overwhelmed me. And so here I am now, I think I was like 63 years old, but I was emotionally a 14, 13 or 14 year old maturity-wise, and I acted like it. And it surprised me, surprised my friends, surprised my wife. It was amazing, but it's what was necessary to open up to how I really felt. When I talk about father, it took quite a while to get a loving, accepting perspective there. I bought into the fact that he's a God of love. I didn't buy into the fact that he was love was personal. I didn't experience that as a child, so I didn't believe it about him unknowingly. And so there are a number of things that happened, you know, subsequent to that, that were, the Lord was just continuing to set me free. And one, for example, I was talking to the Lord one morning, my normal devotions, and I told him, I don't even know where it came from, but I obviously have been thinking it for a long time. I just didn't feel close to him, even though I've been teaching the Bible for years and doing all the right stuff, so to speak. And I said, Lord, I don't feel like you love me. I never used that word with him before, feeling. I was taught, we live by faith. We don't live by feelings. And that word just came out of my soul. I don't feel like you love me. And he is gracious as he is. He rewound me back to 1976 when our daughter died. And in that next day, and Susie's already told that story, but that next day after she died, when we were out in the desert crying out to God, the last ditch maneuver we had, we used Ephesians 5:20, is we cried out to God and we just thanked him in accordance with that passage of scripture. We thanked him for the death of our daughter, which I thought was ridiculous, but that's what that verse says. I saw no value, I had no faith or understanding. I just did it because we had nothing else to do. And in that moment, Jesus showed up. I mean, literally, forcefully, very present, not visually, but in the depth of our soul. I knew it was Jesus. He made himself known clearly. He went to the depth of my soul. I knew exactly who he was and where he went, and I knew Susie had the exact same experience at the same time. And he delivered us from the death of that grief less than 24 hours after she died. So back to my prayer time years later, so I tell the Lord, I don't feel like you love me. He walks me back through that scenario exact. I had every feeling, every experience, and then God said to me, how can you say that? And so that was another major step in him convincing me that his love is abiding and he loved me personally. I'd gotten pretty close with my dad, you know, over the years, and he was more open, and he was dying. He was in his 90s, and he was dying, and went up to see him in the Chicago area, and by that point, we'd hugged, and we said, I love you, and that was pretty cool. Doesn't heal childhood wounds, but it's pretty cool. Anyway, I went to say goodbye to him, you know. It was a Monday. I went to say goodbye to him, and I leaned over, and he took my face in his hand, my face in his hands, and he pulled me right into his face, and he kissed me right on the mouth, and he said, I love you, son. Thanks for coming. And he died the next day. And so that was very meaningful. That was on a Monday. He died on Tuesday. I came back home, and I was supposed to be up at this Wild at Heart conference for men that weekend, coming weekend. I didn't want to go. It was pretty emotional time. And they always talk about father issues, right? I wasn't ready for that. But I had told this young guy that I would take him up there. It was a five-hour drive. So I thought, well, I better go. So I'm going to drive him up there and just spend the night and come back. Turns out I sort of enjoyed the first night there, and so I stayed Friday and Saturday. And then the last thing they did in that conference was they gave you a question, and they said, now go out and ask God this question. And the question is, well, God, how do you feel about me? And here I am again in this same quandary. I mean, how do we even talk to God? Especially, I felt a little disrespectful. How right do I have to ask him a question? Anyway, that was the assignment. So like a good soldier, I went out and I asked God, okay, well, Father, how do you feel about me? Once again, that was a Saturday morning. He wound me back to Monday, and I got a picture of my father taking my face in his hand, pulling me in, kissing me right on the face, and saying, I love you, son. And so he has been, you know, very faithful. That was probably 10 years ago, 8 years ago, something like that. So God has been very faithful to continue to work to convince me that his love is deeply personal. So it doesn't come easily, but I've come to understand it's probably the most important truth that there is. I don't know anything more important than God's personal love. So, but it doesn't come easily because we've all got dads that are not perfect and we're screwed up ourselves. So he's been very faithful to continue to show me. So now that's sort of the bedrock of my life. One reason people don't go back and try and resolve these grief issues, trauma issues, is because it's very painful and you cannot resolve it without revisiting it. You got to go right back into it. You got to own it. You got to say, it's my problem. I'm hurting. And then you got to learn what it means to invite Jesus Christ right in the middle of your pain. That's where he solves issues. He is personally, intimately involved in every area of my life, like all of his children, and he deeply cares. You're in sin, you're in rebellion, you're hurting, you're suffering, you're walking with him. He just presses in. He does not leave. So he is a picture of a father. I hope that what people would hear is how amazing God is as a personal lover of the human heart. How personally he is interested and values and intentional about caring for humans, and specifically his children, those who are open to receive those benefits. The message is the personal nature of God. It's very personal. The deepest, the most intimate details of your life, he's involved and he's interested. Well, I'm 78 years old now, plus, and the emotional growth process, Freedom, started 15 years ago, you know, when I was about 63. Not that I wasn't saved, but the freedom, the emotional freedom, and that is extremely important. So it is an ongoing process. You cannot grow spiritually mature if you're emotionally immature. It's not possible. Emotional immaturity is about you. It's like being a kid. It's about you. And everything about you is in the way. And so this process the Lord walks us through, you can call it sanctification, but the process he walks us through is to grow up emotionally, getting to understand who you are as a child of God, being responsible to face your issues, own it as your issue, like an alcoholic should or whatever, and then process them with God and learn how to process them. You cannot receive love, much less give it, unless you're free. And love only operates in a free environment. The love of God, love for your wife, love for your kids, love for the lost. Only if you have to be free. And the quality of your love is going to be directly related to how free you are, confidently free of who you are as his son and daughter. I was protecting my heart. It was always about being guarded still. And I thought I was free from that. I thought I had released, and I was growing and trust, really learning to trust the Lord. I had not cried since 1976 when my daughter died, and I'm not sure when, if ever, before that. Asking God to go real deep and show me what's my hang up, what am I holding back? What is my unresolved grief? And what he showed me at night was never mad at my parents or upset with them, but the unmet need was that affection that I needed to be valued in the sight of my father specifically was never met. So I tried a lot of different ways to get that need met. You have to understand, well, if you're now an adult and you didn't have the childhood that you really needed to have, that's a loss. You're not going to get it. And a lot of people keep looking for it, and they keep chasing their parents or somebody trying to get those needs met. It's not going to happen. You're not going to go back to childhood, so you got to quit acting that way, and you got to let it go. It's a loss, therefore you grieve it. And as I began to grieve it, that was Easter of this year. And that's when I was going through that study and like that personal prayer time, and the Lord showed me these things. It's when I really began to press in, and I cried. And I cried Friday, and I cried Saturday, and I cried Sunday. I'm still hung up. There's some, I don't just weep openly, so there's still some protecting the heart. It's a growth process. Most of us are way short of what God is giving us in life. If you're an adult, it's normal for you, and you don't know what you're missing. What you do know, if you're paying attention, though, is you are not close with God. You're not close. You can sense that you don't relate with Him real closely. And so that lack of intimacy is because of the emotional immaturity of whatever issues you have in your life. For starters, I'd get real close to God, and I'd start talking to Him real seriously, like Psalm 139. God, search me and know my heart. Try me and see if there are hurtful, wicked ways in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. Because the Spirit of God is really good at that. Pay more attention to what God says about you and the Word of God says about you than how you feel about yourself and what you've accepted, a lot of which you don't even know. I use a book called Soul Care, and it's all about, do you know what's below the surface? What are you wrestling with? What's still there? Are you willing to buy it, accept it? And we'll talk about how to process that freedom. But it's very helpful to have some people walk with you in the little groups that I have. It's just three men, to no more than that, to just get real personal. You can share stuff you don't even tell your wife. You can share your pornography problems, your lustful thoughts, whatever, all that stuff, and you can get it on the table. And until you do that, you're not going to get free. You will not be free. Well, the issue of being macho and cool and tough, you know, that I got in the bars and that I grew up thinking, you know, about myself is changing radically. The idea that you are strong and self-important and self-competent and self-righteous is right out of the pit of hell. I think manhood now, if you want to know what a man really looks like, you need to read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John real carefully and look at the man, Jesus. That's a man. Doesn't defend himself, doesn't put himself forward, walks with his father in complete security. Even when he's falsely accused, he never protected himself, didn't defend himself. He was never guilty. He didn't have to. His interest was in being obedient to the Father, number one responsibility, and therefore loving and meeting every need he came across for their welfare, the glory of God. That's a man. That's the way God designed us to be. So the idea of being humble, meaning learning that you are a very, very important person in the sight of God, but you are a created being, and it's a great place to be a man and to be one of His children, but it's not a self-importance, it's an importance you get from His love for you and His care for you. And so it's a freedom, really, that you don't have to keep proving yourself. You don't have to be tough. You don't have to impress women. You don't have to get more money in your account. It's not really about you anymore. So the performance stuff that I grew up with, it's pretty common to try and excel or impress your parents or make yourself feel better. Stuff just doesn't have much value anymore. I spent a lot more time just talking to the Father and enjoying the Father and spending time just being a son, learning to be what a son really is and being valued, and without having to teach any Bible studies or share the gospel with anybody, just because I'm his.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode. We hope that it encourages you this week.
In this episode, Tim briefly mentions the time when he gives thanks to God for his daughter's death. Susie unpacks that whole story much more in episode 3. We definitely recommend listening to that one. The Story Partners podcast is still very new, but we're already seeing the Lord use it to encourage people. If you've reached out to us to tell us what a specific episode has meant to you, thank you. It really does encourage Walt and I as we continue in this work. If you're willing, we would love for you to take a moment to rate and review the podcast for us. This is a huge help to us as we continue to try to get these stories out to more people.
Thank you for listening to this episode. We hope to see you on the next one. Until then.